There's some other complications that we don't need to get into, but tax reform brought in a new rule. The acronym is GILTI, but the C Corporation helped with that and so forth. So ultimately, you know, as this was structured, the operations basically remaining in the UK, that is what allowed the tax savings, because we were basically paying tax at 17% UK rates on the vast majority of the profits. And then ultimately, we were going to distribute those out and bring them back, two, 3 years later, tax-free.
Hi, folks. It's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Dast. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
The kitchen is my domain. That was our deal.
I don't give a what the deal was. The deal is now changed. Either you stay or you go. It's up to you.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Mark, most of the people that want to exit their businesses always ask the question, what am I going to be left with? After the broker fee, after taxes, can you give me a ballpark idea? And for years, we've done that. And we give some ballpark estimates that change with often the new political party that's in government. In fact, I remember back to 2010 having conversations where that was part of the question. Is our capital gains taxes going to go up? So thinking about what's going to be left after the sale is critically important, especially 7 years later after I sold, when the transactions that we're looking at are much, much larger, $2, $3, $4, $15, $20 million we have now. And these people really, if they focus on the tax savings, will be putting an awful lot more money in their pocket at the end of the day. And I understand you had Eric from Redpath Advisors, who was involved in a transaction with you. He made some recommendations that would have saved, $1 million for the buyer of a business over the course of 3 years, and the seller as well. I understand that there was a tweak of that. It didn't work out exactly the way that he had planned, but there were some amazing ideas there. And you had him on the podcast talking about structures and deals for both tax savings for both buyers and sellers, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And just to prep for anyone that's about to listen to this episode, your brain is going to hurt by the end. Eric is an incredibly smart guy, knows this stuff in and out, was throwing out some numbers and stuff like that I was like, I am so lost. And I was involved in this transaction. This is a continuation of the deal that we talked about with Joseph Harwood, UK deal. I'm calling this series Stupendous Exits. It's kind of snappy, isn't it, Joe?
Oh, I like that. It doesn't flow as well as Incredible Exits.
Though. It doesn't
Stupendous
flow.
Tongue twister.
It's a tongue twister. But anyways, he was one of the advisors on that deal. And specifically, his role was as the international tax law expert. What we were looking at from him in this deal, we wanted to identify how Joseph could capture this 10% effective tax rate that the UK has with under their entrepreneur's relief tax law, but also structure a situation for the buy side, which would represent a tax savings. And what Eric had suggested, and it had merit, we ended up not taking this, but what he had suggested was essentially an acquisition platform that you could build, which would represent a pretty significant go-forward tax savings rate on this acquisition, effectively moving from a 38% federal income tax rate on a business moving forward down to a 20% income tax rate, completely legit, completely legal, just through smart planning. Now, there's some infrastructure and some things that have to happen for this, but when you're looking at this, if you're looking at this from, I want to do multiple acquisitions, I want to build a portfolio, this is an opportunity that I think people should be exploring, which is understanding that there are tax advantages when you're moving internationally, where you can have some pretty significant tax savings that will translate to more money in your pocket at the end of the day. We had Shannon Stewart on a while ago. She talked about tax savings on the sell side. You know, when she said something in there, and I want people to take this at heart. She said, don't just sell your business and think, okay, this is the government's cut. The tax code is a big document. There's a lot in there, right? It's not as straightforward as this is the government's cut. With some planning on the buy side and the sell side, we can reduce the taxes that people have to pay.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing opportunity for those that are buying up or building portfolios of businesses to look at the UK side of it, because so few people are, and the challenge of buying a UK business and transferring that seller account, it's challenging. There are certain things that we need to do now that we've figured out that need to happen in order to make it a transfer over. But I want to shout out to, we have a particular buyer that I looked at his Facebook account, got a message. He's on the way to the UK now with his daughter, and he's bought four from us now. Perfect sort of scenario. If you picture this, folks, that part of the deal is you got to go to the UK once a year for business. You got to have a body or two there that works for you. So once a year, you've got to go to the UK. Doesn't sound like a terrible thing, right?
Not really. No, that's nice.
It's a paid vacation every year through your business, and you get to write it off. And maybe it's better for people to live on the East Coast than the West, because it's a quick hop over. There's lots of perks and benefits to it, and I think it's really important for people at all levels and sizes, whether you're running $500,000 business or a $25 million portfolio, to listen to it all the way through. Even if your head hurts, have a glass of wine, have a beer. Unless you're driving and listening to us, but listen all the way through. It's education. The more you listen to these things, the more you're going to learn, even if you only pick up one little nugget from it. It's important. And Mark and I are guilty of it as well. Mark had him on the podcast. By the end, his head was spinning, but he's going to listen again, as am I. We've got to go through it more than once, and our entire team learns from these as well. So please listen and learn. And to that listener that I'm talking about, that person who we sold four businesses to, if you know it's you that I'm talking about, shoot me a note. All right, let's go on to the podcast with Eric.
Okay, as many of our listeners know, probably about a month or month and a half ago, I had Joseph Harwood on the podcast who spoke about his transaction. He was a UK-based seller, and we discussed some of the challenges in selling a UK-based company. And one of the things that we discussed was just the number of advisors that we had on that deal to kind of work through the murky territory that was that transaction, at least for us. One of the lead advisors of that was Eric Poob from Redpath Capital. Eric is here on the line with me. Eric, thank you so much for joining me on the call here.
Mark, you're quite welcome. Thank you for having me, and happy to kind of chat with you and share some of my thoughts about these cross-border type deals, be it with the UK or Canada, where there are certain things that you can do that I think allow a US buyer and a non-US seller achieve certain tax things so that everybody's kind of happy, if you will, and get the benefits that they're looking for.
Yeah. So before we jump into that, if anybody is from Minnesota, and goes downtown St. Paul, you've probably seen Redpath Capital's Redpath CPA's sign up on a building. But if you're probably about 99% of the audience here, you're thinking, Redpath, who is that? But your history isn't just with Redpath. Why don't you give us a quick background on your background?
Sure. I spent most of my career with Ernst & Young. I'm a retired international tax partner there. Saw a lot of interesting things. And it's understanding those concepts and how you can use them when you're looking at U.S. law, the law of another country, so that you can kind of match up goals that different parties have. That's allowed me to kind of bring value, if you will, to Joseph and his transaction, which when I got pulled in had already been going on quite a while. And I don't want to say it was at an impasse, but both sides were struggling to achieve their objectives. Joseph, being in the U.K., wanted to take advantage of a UK rule called entrepreneurial relief, which allows him to pay tax at 10% if he sells shares, versus if it was an asset transaction, his tax rate would have been north of 50%. And that tax rate delta was extremely material to him in his after-tax takeaway from that transaction. Whereas the buyer wanted to have a structure that drove certain benefits to them, particularly effective tax rates, and that type of thing. And, we were able to come up with a solution, a structure that allowed them to buy shares from Joseph and also put them in a position where if they wanted to kind of move forward under the structure, would have gotten them a much lower effective tax rate than even the U.S. rate. It would save, I'm trying to remember, about 22% less than if they would have done nothing from an effective tax rate on the U.S. side of the transaction. And that would have been kind of a permanent savings going forward as they were running that business and growing it.
Yeah, and I want to unpack this a little bit. Now, let's start with the sell side, right? So there's a lot of UK Amazon businesses. There's a lot of UK businesses in general out there that could potentially be sale, but a UK seller doesn't want to sell them because they understand that most of the market is looking for a type of transaction, just a regular asset transaction, where the effective tax rate, as you said, is going to be upwards of around 50% or more. Correct? Is that correct?
In the transactions that I've been involved with on the sell side, and I've done another one with actually a friend of Joseph's that brought that business to the same buyer. The buyer has a structure that was basically a flow through on the U.S. side, so it wasn't a corporate structure. So they were paying tax at effectively the top U.S. individual rate, which is 37%, plus state taxes on top of that, and they were in a high tax state jurisdiction. So their taxes were directionally 47%. And we were getting it into the low 20s just because of how we were taking advantage on a go-forward basis of the UK rate, which is going to be 17%, because we're going to leave and drive the business from the UK, almost as if Joseph hadn't left, was kind of the concept.
But that would be on the buy side, right? Their go-forward tax rate on the buy side.
Yes, that would have been if they would have kind of gone into the structure like we originally designed it. That is correct.
Right. So, but then on the sell side, though, the effective problem that we're running into is the tax rates. And
in the UK are high, right? Yeah, so if Joseph would not have been able to sell shares, his tax rate would have been a little bit north of 50% on his gain, which in his business was virtually most of the proceeds because of the low basis that he had in the assets and or shares in the company that he had. So it was imperative for him to be able to sell shares to allow him to get access to the 10% tax rate that the entrepreneurial rate allows you to take in the UK.
Now, outside of the UK, we have a couple other countries where we have sort of the same delta in types of deal structures. Canada, for example, has entrepreneurs relief as well.
Correct. They have a similar type rule where, again, if you sell the shares of the company, you can take advantage of preferential tax treatment, somewhat similar to the UK. So on these transactions, and for example, in the UK, the entrepreneurs relief applies to the first 10 million pounds of gain that you generate in this, I'll call it small business stock type sale. And that 10 million is there, and it's a lifetime cap of 10. So it could be two or three small transactions gets you to 10. So Canada has a similar rule that allows you to get a beneficial tax rate if you sell shares. So again, there, I was involved with a Canadian structure about 18 months ago, very similar, where U.S. buyer didn't want to buy shares, wanted to buy assets and actually move the business to the U.S., but ultimately bought the shares and then migrated the actual business, if you will. Different profile, different buyer. It was actually more of a private equity corporate buyer versus in Joseph's transaction, it was a partnership buyer, if you will, flow through. You need to understand both sides of this, the seller, the jurisdiction, their profile, and also the buyer. Is it a corporate buyer, a partnership buyer, that sort of thing, because it drives different tax attributes.
Okay, and that's where some of the complexities come in here with these transactions, where after Joseph's episode, I had a few people reach out and they're kind of like, well, what did you guys do there? And I said, well, I'm not going to go into all the details of everything that we did, but you can't have a one-size-fits-all approach here, right? You do have to cater it towards...
It is customized, correct. I had a base solution that when Mark Yu and Scott reached out, I said, this is the idea. I don't know all of the facts, so let's have a call with Joseph and see if we can kind of get this to work. So we were able to design what I would call the initial structure, and then we shared that with the buyer, who said there's no way that we could do a stock deal and get this to work for anybody. I'm sure you can remember their attorneys kind of starting at that point. And they had a national accounting firm involved on their side, a tax attorney from the law firm. And they came back a few days later and said, we're interested in understanding more. This has merit to evaluate and kick the tires on. And as you know, we basically went through a couple of iterations with the buyer, or in particular the individual that was going to drive the business. Jared is his first name. Very interested in understanding it because of the low tax rates that would allow him to have more after-tax dollars to continue to drive into the business to grow it, which is one of his interests.
Yeah, and to get into that just a little bit more, I mean, the structure that we ended up having set up, if it was just a U.S.-based corporation, and this is all we were doing was a U.S. to U.S., you would have had a corporation, would have been taxed at, what, a 38% maximum income tax rate?
21% federal, and then it depends upon the state that you're in. States go up to, say, 10%, so call it the low 30s at most, probably in the corporate world, correct?
And that would be just for a regular company, like a regular LLC would be that?
No, a regular corporation.
Regular corporation, C-Corp.
C-Corp, correct.
Yes.
You get into the realm of an LLC, and if it has one owner, it gets taxed, and it's an individual, it gets taxed basically in his personal tax return at individual rates because it's effectively a disregarded entity. And then if the LLC has more than one owner, it's taxed as a partnership, and then who are the partners? Is it a corporate partner, an individual partner? And it goes either to an individual up to 37% federally plus states, and then if it's a corporate partner, you're back to the 21% and so on. But in those transactions, when it's domestic, the profile again of the seller is important. Many times you hear that the buyer wants to buy assets so that if they pay a premium, there's this intangible, to get a little technical, this Section 197 intangible that can be amortized over 15 years. So that's why they like to buy assets, so they can get a step up, as we call it. But if the seller is an S corporation, and you've got, one, let's just say it's one guy owns this S corporation, he's running his Amazon business through that, he can still sell shares legally, but give the buyer his step up because there's a special election that can be made, the so-called Section 338(h)(10) election, which, yes, legally it's a share transaction, but for tax purposes, it's deemed an asset sale, which then allows the buyer to get this intangible asset to amortize over 15 years. And in these transactions where you do the election, typically what you see is, because it is an asset sale for tax purposes, and the seller doesn't get capital gains treatment because even though he's legally sold shares, the election takes that away and teaches an asset sale, they typically get a premium on the purchase price because the buyer gets a step up for the premium. So, the kind of the rule of thumb that I've always heard over the years is typically it's anywhere from 14-15% to maybe 18-19% premium over a share purchase price because of the step up.
Right. So in this case, the buyer gets the ability to depreciate the assets over the 15 years that they would normally have in an asset sale, which obviously is a huge advantage from a forward basis.
We're covering a lot of ground, but yes.
We are. My head is spinning. And look, if you're listening to this and your head is spinning as well, you are not alone. And I worked on this transaction and my head is still spinning. The structure that was proposed in this transaction, had the structure that you have proposed been adopted, would have represented a go-forward savings for the buyer of some pretty significant amounts of money in terms of taxes that they would have. One of the obligations of that structure, if I'm not mistaken, would have been to continue to operate in the UK with UK entities. Is that also correct?
That is correct, yes. We had designed a structure, or we brought a structure to Joseph that we presented that would have resulted in the buyer forming a UK holding company to do the transaction so that we could then, if we wanted to, have debts cross-border between the US and the UK. They ultimately decided they didn't want to do that part as we kind of firmed it up, but that gives you one moving part. And that's important on when you've got cash in the UK, coming back to the US, the UK does not have a withholding tax on its domestic law. So dividends can come out of the UK without a withholding tax. And under the new rules in the US, we were talking about forming a C corporation, the buyer, then the UK holding company, and under the Trump tax reform, if you will, from the end of 17, dividends come out of Europe without, out of the UK without a withholding tax and come back and are not subject to tax because of the 100% dividend received deduction. There's some other complications that we don't need to get into, but tax reform brought in a new rule. The acronym is GILTI, but the C corporation helped with that and so forth. So ultimately, as this was structured, the operations basically remaining in the UK, that is what allowed the tax savings because we were basically paying tax at 17% UK rate on the vast majority of the profits. And then ultimately we were going to distribute those out and bring it back, 2-3 years later, tax-free.
Do you remember offhand, I'm not sure how specific we want to get here, but do you remember offhand what magnitude of savings we were talking about over the course of a 3-year period. Was it a few hundred thousand dollars in tax savings?
No, it was more than that. It potentially was going to be, let me just think real quick. It was north of $1 million. I want to recall it was a 1.3 million over 3 or 4 years because of the growth that they were anticipating through the injection of additional capital that the buyer was going to make, as I recall.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I recall as well. I bring that up because I can imagine somebody is listening to this thinking, I left a corporate job and what do I want to do? I want to run an Amazon business. I want to do something sort of simple now. And they're listening to this thinking, wait, I have to have operations based in the UK. What are the obligations there? We actually explored that question in the process of this deal of what were the obligations going to be. And I don't want to be coming across offering legal advice on this, but I believe it required maybe a once per year visit to the UK and having some people in the UK for those operations, if I recall correctly.
Correct. I mean, I would, we're not giving anybody advice. We're kind of talking about something we did back in June and July. Basically, the idea was that we were going to continue to run the business in the UK. It'd be the two or three people there that were running the business would continue to do it. You know, Joseph, who you mentioned, he was going to remain as an advisor into the business for a period of time, et cetera. And the buyer, their role in all of this, I think what you were talking about was some of the corporate governance aspects of this, because we did form a UK holding company. Joseph ultimately, say, 2 years later was going to go away. We were talking about doing board meetings. And we kind of got into this concept of the UK has this mind and management issue, and where are you running the business from? And with the employees in the UK, and with Jared going to the UK a couple times a year, after year end, after the books are closed and approving the accounts, all of those things, that was some of what I would call the operational substance that remained in the UK that allowed it to work.
Yeah, yeah. And so where I immediately, my mind goes from just advising buyers and various aspects over the years is potential opportunity here on behalf of buyers, right? If they're able to set up the structure, I imagine that this is a structure that could probably be used. And once it's set up, used for multiple acquisitions within the UK, see some of this tax savings as well on a go-forward basis, and be able to open up a deal flow that might not exist otherwise here in the U.S. Once the structure is set up, and I'm trying to think about how to ask this question the right way, but how reusable is it in your opinion, or does each deal really require its own development of new companies to be able to manage this? In other words, there's a C corp here in the U.S. for the structure. Do we need to set up a new C corp with every acquisition that we do, or can we use just one general holding pass through C corp?
I see what you're saying. No. The structure. Let's just say that they would have moved forward exactly as we initially designed it, right? And it was all going to work like we had kind of painted that picture, and they said, yep, we're interested. We need to dig into this. We would only need if the buyer was going to do itself additional deals and kind of do a roll-up of 3 or 4 or 5 Amazon businesses from the UK, they just need one C corp. We would have stayed with the one holding company. And then what we would have done is then bought the additional UK targets under that holding company. So I would call it an acquisition platform for a buyer. You just keep bolting on the next one, if you will. So you're not creating additional C corps and or UK holding companies.
Right. So you get this, an acquisition platform is a perfect way to describe it. And again, I saw this as an opportunity. I know Joseph and I talked about it a little bit. I also just had Scott, who was another advisor on this deal on, and we talked about it just a little bit as well. Okay. This is all very...
It's interesting because another one of your UK Amazon sellers that you and Scott know reached out to me last week, and I'll call it for personal reasons and potentially Brexit, he's actually moved to Cyprus. And he has a couple of Amazon businesses and a couple of UK companies, and also a US Amazon business and a US C Corp. And we're looking at how to design a structure for him to continue to build that out. So because he wants to kind of, I don't know exactly where he's at, but let's just see, is it $10 million of revenue? He wants to double that before he wants to take all of it or some of it to market, so that he can grow it and package it in a way where it's easy to actually sell, to allow him to, again, take advantage of, tax rules in Cyprus or Dubai, some of the things that we're talking about. Again, it's him, because he's got some runway and he's single and flexible as to where he wants to live, he's putting himself in a position where he can, you know, significantly reduce or eliminate any sell side taxes down the road so that he can punch his lottery ticket, as he put it to me.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize something here because I think people hear some of this stuff and they think, oh my gosh, this is complex. Is it legal, first of all, and is it going to be triggering an audit and everything else? That's why I wanted to start with your background, right? Your background isn't just some guy who's on the internet researching things, right? This is...
No. In fact, it's interesting. We did have one call. We have another call on Friday. He has been getting some advice from Cypriot's tax advisor. And a lot of the concepts that he was putting out there, I didn't disagree with, but there were some things that they were talking about that I told this individual, I have some concerns. You know, we need substance. We can't play a shell game. Some of the things that were being said could be interpreted as tax avoidance, you know? So, and I said, those are the type of things that I would never advise you to do, because if you want to sell this and a buyer comes in, they're going to do tax due diligence on your structure. And they're going to say, well, okay, you've done all of that, but if you want us to buy the shares so you don't pay any tax, well, there's a tax accrual, or there's going to be, you know, a big number going to an escrow until we get this sorted out. So I agree with you completely, Mark. Understanding the risk profile and what you're doing is important, because I told him if you should go down that path, I'm not going to be an advisor that can help you. So he got the risk conversation, and we just signed an engagement letter, and he wants to move forward through it properly. This whole risk thing, I mean, look at these transactions that you see. The buyers are, you know, using large law firms, accounting firms, and are beating up on the tax due diligence side and putting money in escrow because they're concerned about, for example, sales tax.
Sure, sales tax liability, which came up, and you and I could talk about at length, which we won't, because we'll get into something else. But these are some of the practices that happen at a more sophisticated deal making level than what we might normally see with just a simple transaction, right? This is not uncommon to go through some various tax scenario analysis and figure out a structure that works for the seller, works for the buyer, minimizes taxes on a go-forward basis, and the savings can be significant for everyone.
Exactly. That's why on Joseph's transaction, the buyer was originally a naysayer before I got involved, as you know. And then once we put on the table and they start to understand what was going on, got their advisors to the table so that they could pick it apart. And they said, this has merit. Let's work through this. Right. So that's typically how it's going to evolve. It's not going to be, you know, Eric says this is how it's going to work. I mean, everyone's going to have someone else look at it and get comfortable or not, right? You have to protect your clients. And that's my example with the guy that just moved to Cyprus. I'm not going to put him in a position where he thinks he's saving all this money, but no one's going to want to buy the shares of his company because of the bad tax structure he's put himself into with all of the risk.
Right, right. And ultimately, in the Joseph deal, they didn't accept the very first proposal that we put together. It was a variant of that. Yeah, these things are collaborative in that way. Okay, we've been talking for about 25 minutes. I'm going to wrap it up here, because if we go into another topic, we'll go all the way up to that. My brain hurts. If somebody is interested in talking about this more, Eric, where can they reach you? What's the best way to reach you?
Well, they can reach me here at Redpath. My offices are in St. Paul. I don't know when you publish this or post this, if you can provide my email address, which is last name is Pugh, so it's Pugh@redpathcpas.com.
And if anybody wants an introduction, just let me know. Happy to provide the introduction. Eric, you are a great resource, I think, for anyone in this space, especially if you are doing anything international, even thinking about it on an international basis. Really, really good resource to have. I appreciate it. And your firm as well is a good resource just in general. It's not just an international tax law firm. You guys do the whole gamut.
Correct. Yeah, we've actually over the last 3-4 months through you and us, Scott, connected with a number of companies. In fact, we've just brought on board a larger Amazon business and are doing the bookkeeping and providing other services, including restructuring their business for sale as a domestic business here in the U.S.
That's great. Thanks for coming on. And again, if somebody wants an introduction to Eric, let me know. I'm more than happy to provide it as a way of saying thanks for coming on and also helping out with that deal. It was an eye-opening exercise for me, for sure.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Take care and have a good rest of the day.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light Content Team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast, or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.